This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Fans of the HBO series The Wire, or viewers who missed it on television, can now complete their set. The fifth and final season of the series, which centered on Baltimore cops and drug dealers, as well as the city's politicians, educators, and journalists, is now out on DVD. Here's a scene from season four, in which Omar, a character who robs drug dealers for a living, bursts in on a card game and confronts Marlo Stanfield, the biggest drug dealer in West Baltimore.
All right, everybody, let me see them hands, yo. Hands! Hey, yo, big man, back up.
I don't know about cars, but I think these four fives be the full house.
Hey, yo, banker, cash me out, yo. Boy, you want a hit on that body, you best hop too.
That's my money.
Man, money ain't got no owners. Only spenders. I tell you something else. I like that ring, too.
This ain't over.
Well, that's how you carrying the shorty. Huh?
Because I can find your peoples a whole lot easier than they can find me.
Wear it in health.
No doubt.
Omar is played by Michael K. Williams, Marlo Stanfield by Jamie Hector. The mortal hostility between Omar and Marlo is one of the storylines of Season 5, along with the failure of the city's newspaper to grapple with the complex problems that confront the city. The series creator and writer of many episodes is David Simon, a former reporter at the Baltimore Sun. Many of the stories and characters in The Wire are based on his reporting. Simon's also the author of the nonfiction book Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets, which was adapted into the NBC series Homicide. Terry spoke to David Simon in March.
You had to decide what the fate of each of the characters would be as the series ended. Who gets to live, who gets to die, who gets a second chance, who lives a life of misery.
Yom Kippur in the writer's room.
Can you talk a little bit about what the process was like of deciding the fate of some of our favorite characters?
Well, we've been stealing big. I mean, we've been stealing from a lot of the Greek tragedies. And a lot of the characteristics of the protagonists in those plays are apparent in The Wire. And usually if someone's demonstrating that, they're going to get it.
Give me an example.
Hubris, a willingness to challenge the gods, a willingness to engage in an argument against one's fate. The same things that, you know, Antigone or Oedipus struggled with, we gave the same sort of dynamic to our characters. So there wasn't a lot of escaping that. We knew where people were going for a long time based on that logic.
Who are the gods?
The gods are the post-industrial institutions of modern life.
City hall, the police department, the school system.
Whoever you serve, whoever you serve, wherever your paycheck comes from, whatever calling you thought you had, on The Wire, there's every possibility it will betray you.
You know, the Wire doesn't present any easy answers. There's no real, like, solutions. But we do get a sense of how and why the system doesn't work. We don't learn how to fix it necessarily, but we do come away, I think, with a kind of understanding of the victims within that system. And you walk away with a sense of empathy for people who you might never come in contact with in the real world and might be able, you might be able to, like, demonize them. But watching this series, you just develop empathy for so many people in so many different
situations. I hope so.
Situations.
I do.
One of the things you wanted to do?
Yeah. I mean, I think, in fact, that's about the only victory that you could ask for from a television drama. I think you can't become too didactic and start spouting policy. Having said that, I mean, I think it's the lack of empathy that has led to this disastrous and venal drug war. If we've said anything with The Wire, we've tried to critique the drug war for being what it is. It is no longer, in places like West Baltimore, it is no longer a war against dangerous narcotics. It may have begun as such, but now it is a war against the underclass. And it's being fought by people who have against people who have not. And it is as cynical an exercise as anything I've ever seen. And I was a newspaper reporter for a lot of years. And so if there was a credible critique of anything politically, we hope that was it with the show.
As you said, you were a reporter for the Baltimore Sun for many years and covered crime for many years. And I have February 1994 article from the Baltimore Sun that you wrote that was headlined, "Drugs, a War with Feudal Tactics." And I just want to read an excerpt of that because I think what you were reporting in 1994 is evident in The Wire. You wrote, "There is simply no prison or jail space available for Baltimore's street-level drug offenders, and given the realities of Maryland's fiscal condition, little likelihood that more prison space will soon become available. Nevertheless, much of the Baltimore Police Department's effort in the war on drugs remains geared to arresting street-level violators. The rate of drug arrests in Baltimore remained nearly three times the national average for cities of comparable size in 91, the last year in which such statistics were available. Why? Many reasons, say veteran commanders and officers, not the least of which is the simple overriding fact that no arrest is easier than a street-level lockup for drugs." And then you end the article later by quoting a cop by saying, "The people in these neighborhoods know who the more serious traffickers are, and they know who the people doing the shootings are. When they see the police coming through and leave those people be while grabbing up some small-time tout or junkie, they lose any faith they ever had." So I just read that as an example of how your police reporting informed
what's
in The Wire. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's myself. It's Bill Zorzi, who covered politics for The Sun. It's Ed Burns, who policed Baltimore and then taught in the schools for 7 years. The show is rooted in people who are rooted in a real place. And that's improbable for television. And that's what everyone felt was so subversive. It was a very idiosyncratic message from a very real place.
Let me ask you about another story that you wrote that one of the characters in The Wire is kind of based on. And the story was headlined, "The Metal Men, with quick drug money as their goal, they're stealing and selling every bit of aluminum, iron, brass, and copper they can cart out of city buildings." This is Dateline September 3rd, 1995. And the story was about mostly junkies who were scavenging the city, taking like metal and aluminum off of buildings to sell to companies for scrap. And they were not only doing this out of on abandoned buildings, but they were sometimes taking apart usable, currently in use buildings and destroying them. And here's like one quote from a character named Gary, one of the metal men. And you write, "Gary is the rare metal man. He won't lie about any of it. Fact is, when he's sated with chemicals and the nausea is gone and he can think about things for a few minutes, he's genuinely ashamed. Quote, 'We tore up the boiler in this school for $70 in copper,' he says. 'For $70, we did like $10,000 in damage." Can you talk a little bit about how you got onto the story and what?
Sure.
The repercussions of it, you know, the after effects of it were?
Well, actually, that was the story that ended my career in journalism. You happened to have come across it. Those are the repercussions for me, anyway. There were no repercussions in the outside world, I don't think. I think business went on as usual. But the Gary that you quote is Gary McCullough. And I, you know, 3 years later, I published a book about him called The Corner. And he's no longer with us. But the main characters he was one of the guys, but I actually followed other people to keep it separate from the book for the main narrative of that story. That story got spiked by the editor of the Baltimore Sun without explanation. I think it was towards the end when I had started to critique the paper from within and started to, you know, make arguments for the journalism that I valued. I think he was quite disappointed with me. So he actually, the story was as it ran, ultimately he spiked it. And when I went in to talk with him, it became a wide-ranging conversation about me getting on the team and not criticizing and a variety of things that were as institutional as anything you'd ever see in The Wire. And then one of his other editors came in and said to him, "I don't know why you spiked that story that, you know, you brought me to here to do that kind of work, and you know, why is that sitting in the kill basket? So it ran in the magazine. He wouldn't run it in the paper. He put it in the Sunday magazine, which was on its last legs then. They were about to kill it. But I had made up my mind as a result of sort of that conversation that it was time for me to leave journalism. Because to me, that story was what I valued. It was a nuanced narrative. It held what was happening to account. It talked about the damage done, but it did so in human terms.
So this is an example of why you're so cynical about some editors in The Wire, because there's a couple of editors in The Wire
I'm cynical about everybody in management.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't think they differ from, you know, Valchek, one of the police commanders. He destroys a man because they're fighting over the place of a stained glass window in a Catholic church. So I don't think we're any more cynical about the editors than we are about politicians or police commanders. I think some newspapermen got a little bit upset about it, but journalism's a little bit self-absorbed and onanistic, and you know, it was all fun and games when we were making fun of politicians and police commanders and school superintendents. But you know, God forbid you mock the foibles of an editor in chief somewhere, and now you got trouble.
David Simon created the HBO series The Wire. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's conversation with David Simon, creator of the HBO series The Wire. Before the break, they talked about Gary McCullough, a junkie and metal scavenger who inspired the character of Bubbles on The Wire. David Simon and his co-executive producer Ed Burns, a former Baltimore police detective, shadowed Gary for a year while they were working on their book The Corner. Simon says Gary had no problem with them following him while he engaged in illegal conduct.
Gary was sort of an open soul. Gary was interested in everything. You know, Gary would get high and go to his basement and read. I'll never forget, Gary read Karen Armstrong's History of God.
Really?
The year that we were following him. You know, when Gary one time,
that's
he wanted
pretty,
to...
That's a lot of scholarship. That's not...
It was. And, yeah. And Gary was, he was just open to the world. And the idea that, you know, I should tell a story here, which is that Ed and I would go up to the Corners late in 92, and say, you know, we're going to do a book here. We're this. I'm the guy who wrote Homicide. Ed was a police detective. Yes, I know you remember him. I know he once served a warrant on you. Stop, you know, eyeing him. He is now retired. We're going to do a book. Please trust us. And everyone would go, cops. You know, nobody believed this. And then we went into Gary's mother's house up on Vine Street and met Gary in the living room. And we gave him the same spiel. And he looked at us and went, okay, great. This is going to be an amazing book, you know? I mean, he was a little bit credulous, which was part of his problem in the drug culture. You know, he suffered from being a little bit credulous. And, you know, in our case, we weren't lying, but, you know. But he was really open to the world, and you know, we followed Gary everywhere. And, you know, part of that is he's a little bit preoccupied trying to get through the day, but part of it was just his nature.
So when you were watching Gary steal metal and you knew it was going to be bad for the city and bad for some individuals whose homes or offices he was scavenging from, did it present any moral dilemmas to you as the witness to it?
I confess it didn't. Let me take it a step further. When Ed Burns and I were in that neighborhood in 1993, there was a guy killed. Murdered, stabbed to death on the street, and we knew who did it. We weren't eyewitnesses, but we had all the information as to who did it, why they did it, you know, how it happened, who said what to whom just before the knife went in. I mean, we had the whole thing. Ed had been a former homicide detective, and I had many friends in the homicide unit from having done the previous book on the homicide unit, and we did not pick up the phone and call. When we came into that neighborhood, we told everybody that we were there as journalists, not as police, not as any other arm of the government, that we were there to record life in that neighborhood of Franklin Square and around those drug corners for 1 year. When I gave my word to anybody, in any regard, it's my word. And you know, I have to abide by the terms of the situation if I've given my word. And so, you know, there was no real practical way that I could start mitigating that because certain things had happened. You know, I mean, that's not, you can't play that way. I was there under certain terms. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be able to look everybody in the eye and say, when I told you all this stuff back in 92 about how we would behave, we kept our word.
There's a lot of fantastic African-American actors on The Wire, most of whom I'd never seen before in other roles. How did you get the word out when you were casting?
That's Alexa Fogle, and it's Pat Moran in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
There is a wonderfully deep reservoir of African-American talent. There really is, and they're not working. There's just not enough work. Nobody's writing the parts. What they are writing is marginal at best. And so there's just a natural hunger there. And, I mean, our second and third choices for some of these roles were great reads. You know, sometimes we came back and used them for something else later in the run. I always bristle when I hear people on shows that are supposedly race neutral in their casting. And you know, they come out lily white and somebody asks them about it and they say, well, you know, there's just not that level of talent, you know, among black actors. I hear that. I get furious.
Do you have a favorite casting story?
That's an interesting. Oh, I'll give you a casting story. So we're going to read Wendell Pierce for Bunk.
This is one of the detectives.
Yes, absolutely, and a true character. And by the way, the real Bunk is in our heads because he was named Oscar Requier, and he was quite a character. And he's a wonderful guy, retired now from the police department, just retired. And so Ed and I have this guy in our heads, and you know, Wendell comes in to read in New York, and he just nails it. He is Bunk. You know, and like we're so solid that this is, you know, if this guy's available, the show begins with us casting him. And then after he apologizes, he was a little late for the, and a little flustered. He didn't think he did well. And he started telling this long story about getting in an argument with a New York cab driver about who wouldn't pick him up because he was black. And, you know, he was trying to get here and this and that. And this was the night before and he got locked up. Like, you know, he got in an argument and the police locked him up. And it was in the telling of that story I was holding my side. He told it, you know, in classic Bunk fashion. It came out as if Oscar Requier had been telling it in the Baltimore Homicide Unit. And so the telling of the story was like, you know, no, we don't need to call you back. We're going to call you back when we have a McNulty and you'll read with him, but you're Bunk. And I'll never forget the story because he was infuriated and apologetic at the same time and funny. And that's, you know, to do all three things in a long anecdote in front of a couple of producers and a director and a casting agent. I thought it was a tour de force.
Did you shoot in places that you'd never go to on your own without cameras and a crew because they were too dangerous?
I was a police reporter for a lot of years, and I felt that my city was not Beirut. It was not Fallujah. It was a place that I ought to be able to go with a notepad and talk to somebody if they needed to be interviewed. And so there was no place that I felt like I wouldn't go. I admit to being squeamish when I would have to get in the lifts and, you know, in the elevators
at the
Murphy Homes or the Lexington Terrace at the high rises, mm-hmm. which are no longer there. You know, just that sense of going up and, you know, you got to talk to somebody in unit 10B, you know, in the 770 building and, you know, you're going up and, or the lift is broken, you got to climb the stairs and you're walking past drug deals. That was kind of creepy because, like, you know, I'm going up and I got to come back down. But I always felt like you get about 5 minutes on the street if you know where you're going when everyone's trying to figure out whether you're worth robbing or not. Mm-hmm. You know, you get that 5 minute, like, is that a social worker or is it a cop or I can't, you know, what's that notepad about? And in that delay, I felt like I could go anywhere. And I have to say, you know, I never got robbed in years of being a police reporter and going into every neighborhood in the city. The one time I got robbed, I was with Gary McCullough doing the corner book, and Ed and I were dressed.
This is the metal man, Gary?
Yeah, mm-hmm. He was going to cop, or actually, we were not going to cop. We were just walking on Fulton Avenue, and Ed Burns and myself and Gary and. They thought we looked like two white guys, you know, with Gary who were looking a cop. So they held us up for, you know, the $2.50 I had in my pocket. And it was all very officious and, you know, sort of like pro forma. And then they said, "Is this all you got?" And we were like, "Yeah." And they were like, "Okay, done." That's it. That's the sole extent of the of my violent encounters in Baltimore, Maryland.
Well, David Simon, our time is up. I just want to thank you so much for The Wire.
I want to thank you
for
me.
This conversation. Thank you so much.
I want to thank you. I've been a fan for a long time. I really have been.
David Simon speaking with Terry Gross in March. Simon created the HBO series The Wire. He's currently working on a pilot for HBO set in post-Katrina New Orleans. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.